From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, the aftermath of the dictatorship in Argentina, and the story of one family's search for a missing grandson, and SNL writer Salvadoran Julio Torres on how he found his way to comedy.
Oh my God, ever since I was a child, I was like, I'm just going to live in New York, so I'm just never going to learn how to drive. I never learned how to drive.
Plus, what it's like to portray an icon. We meet Amanda Solis, a nurse by day and a Selena tribute artist by night. That's all coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No te vayas. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And before we get started, we want you to know that on today's episode, we'll be talking about violent incidents, missing children, and death. So if you're listening with kids or just don't feel quite in the mood, you may want to hold off on this one. On an October morning in 1976 in Argentina, a group of armed men suddenly showed up at Jorge and Stella Ogando's door.
Entran a casa un operativo del ejército.
That's their daughter, Virginia Ogando. She says the men put hoods over her parents' heads. As they handcuffed and dragged them out the door, they left little Virginia, who at the time was only 3 years old, in her bed. Virginia's mom, Stella, was 8 months pregnant when they took her. They were taken to a secret prison. It was one of several torture centers operated by the army and the police. Virginia's parents were both in their late 20s. But some of the other detainees were younger, teenagers who had been campaigning for a student discount for bus fare. There was also a journalist, a transgender woman, and a member of an armed leftist group. The prisoners were kept tightly bound, blindfolded, and half naked on the floor. Many had been badly beaten or had burns in their mouths and genitals from being electrocuted during interrogations. Rape was routine. Those who did survive would later remember mostly sounds and sensations, a blasting radio that didn't quite conceal the screams of people being tortured, a thirst so overwhelming it drove one woman to drink urine, the ominous footsteps of guards on the stairs. But there was another sound, too, the cries of newborn babies. About 6 weeks after she had been abducted, Virginia's mother went into labor. The other detainees on her cell block pounded the walls and doors to alert the guards.
Cuando comienza su trabajo de parto,
over the years, the Ogando family has tried to piece together some of what happened next. Virginia says her mother was taken to a kitchen that served as a makeshift maternity ward. That's Virginia's grandmother, Delia Giovanola, who says that the family eventually learned that the baby was born healthy, a boy with light hair and blue eyes, who looked just like Virginia. The guards asked the mother what she wanted to call him. She said, Martín.
Cuando vuelve a la misma celda, ya no trae consigo a mi hermano.
Virginia says her mother came back to her cell without her baby and extremely distressed. The guards told her to calm down, telling her they would take the newborn to her family. But that never happened. Still, Virginia's mother, Stella, had managed to keep a piece of baby Martín's umbilical cord. The prisoners passed it hand to hand, until it reached Virginia's father. It was all he would ever know of his son. In 1976, Argentina's military seized control of the country. This coup marked the beginning of a brutal dictatorship that would last for 7 years and leave some 30,000 people disappeared, according to human rights groups. The dictatorship used the threat of Marxist terrorism to justify its actions. Anyone it considered subversive would be a target. Some of those who disappeared did belong to armed leftist groups, but many others were also just student activists or union members and people whose names were simply in the wrong address book. About 500 babies also disappeared. They were either born in torture centers, like Virginia's brother, or stolen. Many of these children were not killed, but they weren't given back to their families either. The regime considered them seeds of subversion. And so giving them back to their biological families, they thought, would only create a new crop of terrorists. Instead, the children were raised under false identities, adopted by families in or close to the regime, sold on the black market, or abandoned at orphanages. But their blood relatives never stopped looking for them. Here's reporter Bridget Huber with the rest of the story.
After her parents went missing, 3-year-old Virginia went to live with her grandmother, Delia. Delia was a school principal, but she quit her job to take care of Virginia and search for Virginia's parents. She thought they'd be released soon. These were the early days of the dictatorship, and people didn't understand the scale of what was happening. The press was censored, and the years leading up to the coup had been tumultuous, with violence from far-left groups and right-wing paramilitaries backed by the government. Delia wasn't alone in thinking, at first, that the new regime might restore order. This propaganda film, released by the dictatorship just a month before Virginia's parents disappeared, says the armed forces took power to save the country from agents of chaos. The regime used talk like this to justify the repression, but historians would later say the armed left was mostly neutralized within a year or so of the coup. As far as the family knows, Virginia's parents weren't militant activists, but they were definitely sympathetic to the left. Virginia's mother, Stella, was a lawyer representing a union, and one of Virginia's father's friends had disappeared. 9 days later, he and Virginia's mother disappeared too. That's when Virginia's grandmother, Delia, started to look for her son and daughter-in-law.
Empezamos la búsqueda del hijo.
She'd go to courthouses, government offices, newspapers. Then, a few months after the disappearance, Delia started going to the Plaza de Mayo in Buenos Aires. She'd bring Virginia, now a preschooler, to the big open square that's right in front of the president's office. There, women whose sons and daughters had gone missing would meet each week. This was during one of the most brutal periods in the dictatorship. Public assemblies were forbidden. So the women walked in circles around the plaza. The group was infiltrated by intelligence agents, and some of the women would disappear too. But still, each week, more and more mothers would show up to the plaza. They started wearing white kerchiefs on their heads. They'd embroider the cloth with their missing children's names. That's the sound of some of the mothers talking to French reporters during one of their marches in 1978. Bureaucrats denied the women's children were missing, saying they'd probably just run off to vacation in Europe. People called Delia and the other mothers
Las locas de Plaza de Mayo.
The crazy ladies of the Plaza de Mayo. At the plaza, Delia met other women who, like her, were searching for their missing grandchildren. These grandmothers started to work together.
Y ahí nos juntamos muy poquitas, seríamos cinco,
At first,
seis.
They were just a handful of women. They'd meet in cafes and parks, bringing props like birthday presents or knitting so they could pass themselves off as harmless grannies on a social call. But really, they were planning their own investigations. Wherever kids might be, they went. They hung around schools, toy stores, candy shops, hoping for a glimpse of their missing grandchildren. Now Delia's 91 years old. The crazies who'd skulked around candy stores are now a venerable human rights group, the grandmothers of the Plaza de Mayo. They put ads on buses and on TV, urging people with doubts about their identities to get in touch. The ad says, if you were born between 1975 and 1980 and think you could be a child of the disappeared, contact the grandmothers. When the grandmothers first started searching, they'd comfort themselves by saying that someday The stolen babies would grow up, wonder about their origins, and start their own searches.
Y últimamente ellos solitos vienen.
And that's what started to happen, Delia says. Now the missing grandchildren are coming forward on their own. Virginia's classmates all knew about her disappeared parents and the lost baby, Martin. To her great annoyance, Delia told everyone they met. But Virginia didn't feel like the story was hers, and she didn't want any part of the search.
Nunca quiso formar parte.
She never even asked about her mother and father, Delia says. Despite it all, Virginia was a happy kid. She loved racing around on her bike and spending summers at the beach in Mar del Plata, where the family had an apartment. She'd quickly learned to shut down questions about her family. I live with my grandparents, she'd say. I don't have a mother or father. Virginia didn't remember her parents. Sometimes, when she was in elementary school, she'd break down crying, afraid they might come back and take her away from Delia. But things started to change once Virginia was around 20. She got a job at the bank where her father had worked until he disappeared. His friends there urged Virginia to look for her brother, Martin.
Yo creo que es un click que...
Something clicked, Virginia says, and suddenly she wanted to know everything about her parents. For the first time, Virginia joined in the search for her brother. One day, when Virginia was in her early 30s, a woman came in to see her at the bank. The woman said she knew a couple that had adopted a son under suspicious circumstances in the 1970s. The parents always acted strangely, the woman told Virginia. They seemed to try to keep the kid hidden. The woman gave Virginia a whole series of details. The boy, by this time a grown man, had curly blonde hair and freckles, just like Virginia. Even the name was right, Martin. Virginia staked out the man's house. She parked outside and waited until he came out. When he did, he looked just like the photos Virginia had seen of her father. Virginia introduced herself, and the man took to the idea that she might be his sister right away. He was adopted and had been told his mother was a prostitute, but never totally believed it. The two bonded fast. Virginia introduced the man to her friends and family. He'd stay at her house all the time. The pair went for DNA tests, but even before they got the results, they were calling each other brother and sister. One day, Virginia called her grandmother Delia.
Me llama Virginia y me dice, abuela, ¿sabes con quién estoy hablando?
You'll never guess who I'm talking to, she said. A man's voice came on the line. Delia had a bad feeling. The man seemed too eager, too overfamiliar. Then the man started asking different family members about money. The government pays reparations to the dictatorship's victims. He was telling people he hoped Virginia hadn't spent his share. When the DNA test results came back, they showed, definitively, there was no way he was Virginia's brother.
Coming up on Latino USA, we continue Virginia and Delia's search. Stay with us, no te vayas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, supporting the U.S. Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, and encouraging the U.S. Hispanic community to learn more about the benefits of getting screened for the early detection of cancer. More at noesperes.org. And the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, whose Clinical Scientist Development Awards support promising early career physician scientists and their research efforts to improve human health.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And when we left, Virginia and Delia had just suffered a big disappointment. The man Virginia thought was her long-lost brother was actually just an imposter hoping to earn a quick buck. But they didn't give up. Bridget Huber picks up the story.
When a kid gets lost at the beach in Argentina, people do this kind of amazing thing. Someone grabs the child and they put them on their shoulders. Then they begin to clap, and the people around them start clapping too. And then the people around them start, and so all around the child, the clapping gets louder and louder, until finally the frantic parent follows the sound of the clapping to their child, and they reunite. It was a spectacle Virginia had seen countless times in her summers at the beach in Mar del Plata. Despite her earlier disappointment, Virginia pushed on in her search for her brother, Martin. She told her family's story in a documentary called Hermanos de Sangre, which is where we got our audio of Virginia.
La necesidad de encontrarlo, simplemente saber que tengo un hermano dando vueltas por ahí por la vida y que no nos conocemos.
Virginia says, I have a brother who's lost out there somewhere, but we don't know each other. Virginia started writing open letters to her brother, Martin, and posting them on Facebook and a blog. People would respond. They'd send little notes wishing her luck. They were accompanying her in her search and amplifying it. She could almost hear the sound of clapping, she wrote in one of her letters. It seemed to be getting louder. Around that time, Argentina was in a new phase of reckoning with the crimes of the dictatorship era. After the regime fell in 1983, the country held landmark human rights trials and convicted a handful of high-ranking officials. But then the military threatened rebellion, and the government passed laws limiting more prosecutions. Eventually, all of the people who had been convicted were pardoned and set free. But then in the 2000s, human rights groups finally won a series of victories that cleared the way for a sweeping new round of trials. The grandmothers were no longer the crazies. Now they were appearing on stages with the president. Every time a stolen grandchild was identified, it was all over the news. The search for justice was reinvigorated, and Virginia was full of hope. In one of her open letters to her brother, Virginia told him she felt his homecoming was imminent. She wrote, I feel our tomorrow is coming closer. For years, Virginia had been trying to gather as much information about her parents as she could, so she could share it one day with her brother.
Siempre trato de poder armar el rompecabezas. Quiero poder contarle todo esto que estoy recogiendo ahora, poder contárselo a mi hermano.
I'm always trying to put the puzzle together, she said. She tracked down her parents' old friends. She wanted to know everything. What did they like to eat? What made them laugh? Where would they hang out? Virginia's search had never overwhelmed her. If anything, it seemed to make her brighter, more ferociously vital. Even though she was no longer rejecting her history, she was still that sunny child. She was an adrenaline junkie who loved motorcycles and ziplining. She even took Delia rappelling when she was 82 years old. At a certain point, though, she started to get obsessed. And Delia noticed.
Estaba obsesionada. Le escribía cartas.
Virginia took a leave of absence from her job. She needed the time to look for her brother and find out more about her parents, she said. But sometimes she spent entire days in bed. And then Virginia had a visit from the woman who'd been her mother's cellmate in the Pozo de Banfield, the secret prison. Virginia had talked with the woman many times in the past, but she always had the feeling she wasn't getting the whole story. This time, Virginia told friends, she wanted to know everything, even the most terrible details.
Me dijo, estoy preocupada, abuela. Dice, yo no estoy bien. Y me extrañó y le pregunté, ¿y por qué no? ¿Qué te pasa? ¿Qué? No sé, tengo miedo. ¿Pero miedo de qué? De mí.
Virginia sunk deeper into depression. One day, she told Dahlia she was worried. "I'm afraid," she told her. "Afraid of what?" Dahlia asked. "Afraid of myself." Now Dahlia sees that she was asking for help, but she didn't realize it at the time.
Y seguramente me ha de haber estado pidiendo auxilio, pero yo no lo supe ver.
For a little while, things seemed to be getting better. Virginia agreed to try therapy and medication. She even started talking about going back to work. But then, in August 2011, she drove her truck to Mar del Plata, the beach city where she'd spent her summers. She went to the family's apartment on the 20th floor. She opened the window, and she jumped. She left a note saying she had gone to join her mother and father.
Pero jamás me iba a imaginar un final así, que cuando me dieron la noticia, es como que se abrió la tierra y no lo podía creer.
When Dahlia got the news, she says she felt like the earth had swallowed her up. She couldn't believe it. She started howling, banging her head on the table and the wall. When the dictator's death squad had come to Jorge and Stella's door 35 years earlier, it had spared their daughter, Virginia. Now, Dahlia felt like it had come back to claim her. Almost 5 years later, I meet Dahlia at a condo on the outskirts of Miami.
¿Tomas mate?
Sí.
Ah.
We're not alone.
Ahora, okay, bueno.
Next to Dahlia is a man, 39 years old. He has blonde hair, few freckles, and bright blue eyes.
Mi nombre nuevo es Diego Martín Ogando, y el que usé en toda mi vida anteriormente, desde que tengo uso de razón, es Diego Berestiqui.
It's Martín, the brother Virginia had been searching for. He goes by Diego now. Here's how this happened. After Virginia died, Dahlia threw herself into the search for her grandson. She felt she owed it to Virginia. Dahlia traveled all over telling her story. Around Easter in 2015, she gave a talk in a small town. As a present for the local priest, she brought a white kerchief, like the one she'd put on for the first time 39 years before. Dahlia's not a fervent Catholic, but she's not immune to signs.
A mí me ha ocurrido una cosa muy rara, muy rara. Yo empecé a notar señales en mi vida.
Something very strange happened to me, Dahlia says. I started noticing signals. After the priest celebrated Mass, he came to her, and he told her he had had a vision during the benediction. He'd seen Virginia dancing with the angels. He told her,
Vas a tener noticias de Martín.
You're going to have word from Martín. Dahlia felt this rush of closeness with her granddaughter. She felt like Virginia was pulling strings. Right around this time, Diego was getting on a plane in Miami to go to Argentina. His adoptive father, Armando, was dying of lung cancer. It was time to say goodbye. Diego grew up in Buenos Aires. He'd always been told he was adopted, but the truth was more complicated.
Ellos me fueron a buscar como que a una clínica. A una clínica donde había varios bebés y ellos, bueno, básicamente pagaron por mí.
His adoptive parents hadn't been able to have kids, but they wanted them badly. Adopting was an arduous process that could take years, but it could be easily circumvented with cash. So the couple sold a car and borrowed some money. They went to a clinic and brought home a blonde, blue-eyed baby boy with a fake birth certificate. They named him Diego.
Y bueno, ellos, si bien no sabían que yo era hijo de desaparecidos, pero sí sospechaban de que podría llegar a serlo.
As time went on, it became clear that it was possible that Diego was one of the babies who'd been stolen during the dictatorship. Diego was mostly raised by the man he considered his father, Armando. Armando told him that if he wanted to get a DNA test to find out where he came from, he'd support him. But Diego didn't feel much of a need to find out. For starters, he loved Armando. He was an adoring dad. He gave Diego all of the affection and material things he could have asked for. And also, Diego was much more focused on his own future than his country's dark past. In the late 1990s, Argentina was in political and economic crisis. Diego was carjacked at gunpoint, and he just didn't see much of a future for himself in Argentina. He'd visited Miami once before and loved it. So he and his girlfriend moved there, eventually got married, and had two daughters. Life was full. But the big reason why Diego didn't get a DNA test, he was trying to protect Armando. In the new round of human rights trials, some people who adopted children of the disappeared have been prosecuted, even if they didn't know the exact origins of the babies they raised. Diego was already on the airplane waiting to take off when he learned he was too late. Armando had died.
Cuando yo tomé, él ya estaba muy grave. Yo tomo el avión acá en Miami y en ese mismo momento él muere, él fallece. Entonces yo ya viajé sabiendo que él había fallecido.
After the memorial service, Diego spread Armando's ashes at the ocean as he'd wished. Then, 5 days later, in March 2015, he went to Buenos Aires to the grandmother's office. He said he wanted to have a DNA test. The Argentine government runs a gene bank that holds samples from hundreds of people searching for disappeared relatives. Diego had been told that if the DNA test came back positive, he'd hear quickly, in 2 months at most. But there was no word for more than 7 months. Finally, in November 2015, he got a call while he was at work.
Me dice, bueno, te dio positivo, y ahí me empieza a contar la historia de mi familia, de mi nueva familia.
The woman on the phone told Diego his DNA had matched with someone else's, Virginia's. She started to tell him about his new family, about Delia, that she was one of the first grandmothers of the Plaza de Mayo. And she told him the super sad part, he says, about his sister Virginia, who killed herself about 4 years earlier in 2011.
Me habló de la abuela que tenía, de Delia, que era una de las principales abuelas de Plaza de Mayo y que era fundadora, fue la que una de las que fundó la institución. Y también la parte súper triste me habló de Vicky, que era mi hermana, y que, bueno, que se termina suicidando en el 2011.
Then Diego asked, was his grandmother there? The woman told him she was, but he'd have to hold the line while they found her. The grandmother's headquarters is a rambling old mansion. When Delia arrived earlier that morning and got the news, she'd cried and screamed and collapsed in a chair. Then the house started filling up with well-wishers, other stolen babies who've reunited with their biological families, and journalists. Every time another stolen baby is found, there's a big party and a press conference. At the press conference that day, Delia was surrounded by other grandmothers, friends, and family. The head of the grandmothers announced that Delia's grandson had been found. Delia was asked to say a few words, but she, uncharacteristically, was tongue-tied.
Hablo. Hablo, pero hoy no puedo.
When she found her voice, Delia said she was happy and grateful to know the hand of her granddaughter Virginia was behind all of this.
Muy contenta, pensando que la mano de mi nieta está atrás de todo esto. Cumplí.
Presente.
Ahora y siempre.
Ahora y siempre.
Usually it takes some time for the newly identified grandkid to start talking with their biological family. It can be a gradual process, often mediated by psychologists. So when Delia heard that her grandson was on the phone and had asked to talk to her, she went running.
Y bueno, y ahí agarré el teléfono y lo primero que se me ocurrió gritar, Martín, Martín, sos vos, Martín.
Martín, Martín, is it you? She asked. Diego was caught off guard.
Yo no estaba acostumbrado. Mi nombre toda la vida fue Diego. Pero ella me había buscado todos estos años como Martín.
He laughed. His name was Diego, but they'd looked for him all those years as Martín. Since that day, Diego and Delia have been making up for lost time. Diego's visited Delia several times in Argentina, and she's crazy about her great-granddaughters.
Ese me gustó más.
And the two have had some adventures that would have made Diego's daredevil big sister, Virginia, smile. That's Delia driving a speedboat in the Paraná River this year, not long before her 91st birthday. These days, Diego's trying to integrate the two parts of himself, Diego and Martín. At first, it was weird. He visited family members and friends of Virginia's. They'd cry and hold him close. They felt like they knew Diego, but to him, they were strangers.
Como que para ellos, como que ellos sí me conocían, entre comillas, y me esperaban y no sé qué, y yo no.
Overall, Diego says learning about his new family has been an injection of happiness. But the shadow over it all is the fact that he missed Virginia by just 4 years. On one of his visits home, Diego and Delia went to the house where his parents were living when they disappeared. He also went to the Pozo de Banfield to see where he was born, where his parents were tortured. He stood on the curb and took pictures, but he couldn't bring himself to go inside. He says seeing the place where his parents suffered couldn't do him any good. On the outside of the building, though, there's a mural of Delia surrounded by doves and white kerchiefs. And someone left a message for Diego there, too.
Que en las paredes está puesto, por ejemplo, Bienvenido 118. O sea, yo, ¿no? Nieto recuperado 118.
There on the wall, someone painted, Welcome, number 118. That's Diego, 118th child of the disappeared to be found.
Entonces estuve ahí, me saqué varias fotos, y en la parte esta donde dice Bienvenido 118, lo firmé, puse acá, puse Gracias por buscarme, y puse en 118.
Underneath the message, Diego signed his name with a marker. He wrote, Thank you for looking for me.
Thanks to Bridget Huber for bringing us that story, which we first aired in July of 2017. A written version first appeared in the California Sunday magazine. You can find a link to that on our website, latinousa.org. And a final note to the story of Delia, Virginia, and Diego. Altogether, 128 of the stolen babies have so far been found, but hundreds are still missing. 6 of the missing children were found in 2017 alone, so the search is still very much alive. Coming up on Latino USA.
There's something I think childlike about what I do. And if you like it, great. And if you don't like it, well, that'll bum me out a little bit, but you won't know that.
Stay with us. No te vayas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Gruber Family Foundation, supporting NPR's international coverage, covering the trends, moments, people, and movements that drive the world, always with the goal of creating a more informed public, one challenged and invigorated by events, ideas, and cultures, and the Jack Kent Cook Foundation, providing scholarships throughout the nation to exceptionally high-achieving students. with financial need from middle school to college. More information about Cook Scholarships is available at jkcf.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And if you've ever watched SNL at all over the last year, then you probably know the work of Julio Torres. Torres is a Salvadoran stand-up comedian and writer for Saturday Night Live. You can almost always tell when you're watching one of his pieces because of his, well, his unique sense of humor. His skits include one from the point of view of a gaudy bathroom sink.
Am I too much? Oh my God, I'm simply too much. I'm gigantic.
Or the skit Melania Moments.
Melania Trump approached a window in Trump Tower and gazed down on Fifth Avenue. She saw a man walk just out of sight and wondered, what happens to them? To the people, once they leave Fifth Avenue? Where do they go? Do they disappear? Is there a Sixth Avenue? Is there a Fourth Avenue?
So my relationship with Saturday Night Live is like any romantic relationship, mm-hmm. long term. Mm-hmm. There's ups and downs.
Yes.
Like the whole Latino thing, mm-hmm. rather the absence of, you know, it just kind of gets to you. But then this guy that I actually know and love, Lin-Manuel Miranda, mm-hmm. is asked to host the show. And there's this one scene that I just watched and I was like, oh my God, I love this so much. It's Lin-Manuel as the recent immigrant in a phone booth.
Pero mamá. Ay, mamá. ¿Qué tal estás?
And then, you know, it's supposed to be the American dream, right? But then quickly it becomes the American nightmare all around disgusting food.
Los americanos comen algo que se llama marshmallow salad. Marshmallow salad. No vegetales. Marshmallows.
Right. I don't think his character saw it as disgusting. I think that he was fascinated by it. Yes. I think he has nothing but love for this new world that he has encountered. And he's very wide-eyed.
Preston me mostró lugares bonitos en North Dakota como el Walmart, el 7-Eleven, el Cornfield, el otro Walmart, el otro 7-Eleven.
It seemed like the skits that you write for Saturday Night Live are always kind of like looking from the outside in.
Yeah.
I mean, I definitely feel your cultural observation, which is why as I look at your work, there's a lot of times when I felt like I intuitively connected with it because of the fact that you have this kind of outsider's gaze. How do you understand that?
I'm aware of it. It was not designed that way, if that makes sense.
Talk to me about your El Salvador.
Well, let's see. I've lived in San Salvador my whole life. It's not until I moved to New York, which is the only other place I've lived in, that you sort of look back on it and start questioning, but also just seeing it through a different lens. I was lucky enough that my parents worked really hard and they could put me in a nice, very posh elementary school and high school.
So like a private school?
Yes, a private school, yeah.
How did the other kids from San Salvador look at you?
I was not social at all. I did not get along with the other kids. It was never like hostile, but it was always just a mutual understanding that we were different and that we just had very little to say to each other. So I would stay in my room, and like my childhood was just being in my room and playing alone.
Well, let me ask you about that. You say that the other kids, like, it was like mutual distance.
Yes. Distance is a nice way to put it, yeah.
What do you think that they saw in you that made them want to be like, yeah, ese Julio?
Well, I think homogeny is such an important part of the Salvadorian experience, at least in my experience. People are very comfortable with people being a certain way. Of them looking a certain way, of them acting a certain way, of them being interested in a certain thing. And then when you add to that a layer of private school, that turns into what kind of car do your parents have? Where do you vacation? And like all of these things that become so important.
Okay, so take me from the dream mm-hmm. to how you get here.
I applied to the new school. They gave me a scholarship that wasn't enough. So then I kept going to school down in El Salvador. Then a couple of years later, I reapplied and they gave me more money, which still wasn't enough, but just enough to make it work. I came here and it was like every semester felt like, is this going to be the one that ends it all? And I just thought, no, I just have to get straight A's and make it to graduation and then someone's going to give me a job.
Where does comedy suddenly make its way into? Because you haven't mentioned comedy.
I haven't mentioned comedy at all.
It seemed like you were more like a sad kid. Like,
yes. Yeah, correct. I didn't want to be a stand-up comedian till the day before I tried it.
When you went up for stand-up that very first time, mm-hmm. was it the Julio that we now know in stand-up? Because
no.
Your character in your stand-up now is pretty trippy.
No, it wasn't. It was that version of me trying to look and act normal, if that makes sense. I would take the mic out of the stand and then I would like lean on it, just sort of like mimicking the body movements of what I thought a stand-up comedian should have. I would just like try to look like I was having the easiest time of my life. And then it was almost like as I got more comfortable being me, I got more comfortable being uncomfortable. In my experience, the hardest part about being vegan is all of the apologizing. People ask me if I miss meat or dairy. I miss being liked.
But in part, it's also developing a character.
Accidentally, but yes.
Who is that character?
I, like many or most stand-up comedians, I'm sort of like an exaggerated version of myself on stage. There's something I think childlike about what I do. Very sort of like, oh, I'm not going to run after the ball. I'm just going to stand here and do what I do and be utterly inflexible. And if you like it, great. And if you don't like it, well, that'll bum me out a little bit, but you won't know that.
And so what's the dream right now?
Fred Armisen and I have a pilot together, and hopefully that'll become a show. That would be great.
And it's in Spanish, right?
It's in Spanish, yeah.
And how do you feel about doing a show that's fully in Spanish when your writing is really mostly in English, your comedic writing?
You know, I had never performed comedy in Spanish just because I left before I was fully developed. But I loved it. For a moment, just so giddy to like make these observations that couldn't work if they weren't in a show in Spanish.
Julio, thank you so much for joining me on Latino USA.
Thank you for having me. This was so great.
You can catch the work of Julio Torres on Saturday Night Live or with Fred Armisen in the upcoming Spanish-language comedy from HBO, Los Spookies. And to close out our show this week, we're going to ask the question, what is it like to portray an icon? Texas native Amanda Solis is a nurse by day and by night, a Selena tribute artist. But she didn't set out to imitate the queen of Tejano music. In this edition of How I Made It, our series on Latino creators and the work they make, she shares how she started on this unexpected path.
It's hard at times to go out there and do what I do because I'm going to get so much backlash. How dare you? Who are you to think that you could do this and try to live a life as Selena? And then they finally get to know who I am at that moment after I perform, and they get to see that at the end of the day, I'm always Amanda. My name is Amanda Solis, and I am a Selena tribute artist. Growing up, we definitely had our barbecues outside. You know, everybody come over. We're going to make some barbecue. They're going to have some drinks, you know, and listen to Tejano music, like Ramon Ayala. To me, Tejano is, it's Texas. I feel like it's the Spanish version of country music. Tejano music is our roots. We listen to that music. As soon as it comes on, first thing you're doing is going and grabbing you a partner and running out there and starting to dance and cut a rug on the floor.
En tu casa no me quieren por borracho, porque dicen que me gusta vacilar. No me importa que me acusen de esa forma.
After my parents had passed away, at the time I was 6, it was very hard for me to come to an understanding on realizing that they were never going to come back. I think I kind of just thought of it as, oh, they're on vacation. You know, I know it's not funny, but kind of funny because I was like, I'm thinking that they're on vacation and they're just going to come back one day. But as I grew up, I mean, obviously coming to realize at that age, I didn't really understand the full, they're never coming back. So growing up, we've always listened to Selena's music. Now, I had never seen her at that time. I only heard her on the radio and heard of her. But the first time that I had seen her on TV is when I was taken back, like, holy macaroni, like, this girl's got it going on. And she was performing live in Monterey. And she had this white shirt on and this short, like a skirt, really, you know, shorts and a skirt. And she had these country boots on, and man, she just had this voice and her moves. But not only whenever I was shocked about that, it was just more of like, wow, like, hold on. She kind of looks like my mom. And I think maybe it was because like her style. Back then, that was like the 90s, bustiers and those skorts and the red lips and things of that nature. It was just like, wow, she reminds me of my mom some way. And I was just admiring her at that moment. I never thought being a Selena tribute artist would even be possible. Like that was never a thought in my mind. 4 years ago, my friend was like, hey, let's go out this weekend. Let's do something. My good friend, who's a karaoke DJ, she's going to be at 504. Let's go. And I said, all right, cool. Well, we end up going, you know, just to go hang out. And then she was like, hey, I think you should enroll yourself in singing and sing Bitty Bitty Bum Bum or something. You know, you already look like Selena. You know, and I just started laughing because like growing up, yeah, people had told me time to time that I did resemble her. The first time that I was told that was probably at my quinceañera whenever my tío was telling me, he's like, now that you've grown up, you look like Selena. And I end up getting first place. And I'm like, what? You know, because I'm thinking like, there's no way I'm going to do this. These people are going to, I'm going to break the windows when I sing. And these people are going to run away. Like, I don't know. And Mama Cass, which was the DJ that was holding the competition, she was like, oh, well, by the way, now that you placed first place, this is going to take you to the second round. And I'm like, what? Like, you're kidding, right? You know, she's like, no, seriously. And so pick another song and then you'll perform again on this date. And then you'll win for the big prize. So I went and I sang Que Crias, which is one of my favorite songs by Selena. Mind you, I never thought that I really could carry a tune. This was just for fun. And sure enough, I ended up, out of all those people, I ended up placing second place. Didn't think anything of it after that. And then all of a sudden, well, you know how social media is and YouTube and people have access to video you and put it on their pages and things like that. And that's basically how it spread. And then like 2 weeks later, I get a phone call from this lady that says, hey, is this Amanda? And I'm like, yeah, this sure is. And she was like, well, I seen your video on YouTube. And I was like, okay, my video on YouTube. She was like, yeah. She goes, I seen that you were performing as Selena. Is this what you do for a living? And I kind of like chuckled about it. And I was like, no, let me see this video because I never seen it and I've never posted anything on YouTube before in my life. And so she was just like telling me about how, you know, they grew up on Tejano music and they love Selena and that her daughter was a huge Selena fan and that her daughter's birthday was going to be coming up. And I was like, okay. She was like, well, I would really love for you to come out and perform. And I was like, well, you understand, I don't do this. She was like, that's fine. She goes, my daughter, she's turning 45. We're doing like a quinceañera for her, even though it's not like a 15, you know, she was turning 45. Well, come to find out her daughter had Down syndrome. And growing up, she's always listened to Selena hardcore. And so I said, you know, okay, I'll practice on a few more songs for you. And definitely, I'll go out there and I'll do this. She was like, well, how much do you charge? I was like, I'm not going to charge you crazy. Like, this is just for fun. And it was just a beautiful thing. I ended up doing it, going out there, and I was able to touch this girl's life. It's crazy on how many times, like now that I've performed on these stories, like if you were there to hear these people, like they cry to me. They tell me these things that I've never heard before. Like that lady that had never met me before, the first one that called me to perform for her daughter, had donated the purple jumpsuit to me, literally paid out of her pocket. And I was like, no way, you don't have to do that. And I was like, well, I just want to let you know that I'm so grateful. You know, I'm definitely going to pay it forward. She was like, well, that's what you're doing by doing what you're doing for my daughter. At that time, it's like the seed was planted and I ran with it. People ask me, like, how do you prepare yourself to become Selena? But I don't, because this is who I am all the time, minus me, you know, putting my bangs like her or putting on the red lipstick. But what Latina doesn't wear red lipstick? Everybody's like, oh my gosh, you even altered your laugh to sound like her. And I'm like, how is that even possible? The only things that I prepare that are the hardest things for me to do to get into character would be the costume. And practicing to sound good so that I make sure I hit my notes right, you know, and to be a good performer, to basically back up that I'm paying tribute to such an iconic person.
Late at night when all the world is sleeping, I stay up and think of you. And I wish on a star that somewhere you are thinking.
Amanda Solis is a Selena tribute artist from Texas City, Texas.
'Cause I'm dreaming of you tonight, till tomorrow.
That's it for today. Latino USA is produced by Miguel Macias, Antonia Cerejido, Andres Caballero, Maggie Freeling, Janice Yamoka, and Sayer Quevedo, with help from Fernanda Chavarri. We're edited by Marlon Bishop and Sofia Paliza Carr. Our engineers are Ginny Montalvo and Stephanie LeBeau. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholz. Our fellows are Virginia Lora and Jesse Alejandro Cottrell. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. And if you like the music you heard on this episode, be sure to stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Be sure to check us out on all of your social media, and I'll see you there. And until next time, hasta la próxima. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the Marguerite Casey Foundation. Change for families by families. The Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
My daughter is vegan.
Great.
Really?
Yeah.
You think so?
I think so.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and developing countries, and working to inspire and enable the next generation of inventors. More information is available at lemelson.org. And the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, bridging the cultures of science and the arts by supporting new books such as Energy, A Human History by Richard Rhodes, chronicling 500 years of energy transitions. This is NPR.